It's the same recorded message you've been singing all along. Keep handing us the Bible while you're walking off with all the gold. The bureaucratic office sends you merry-go-rounding, while the KKK police the streets by bloodhounding. Interest on the credit card. All right, and you're listening to Public Affairs Hour. My name is Yuri Rashkin, and we are going to be talking today about Russia and about Sochi Olympics. Joining me, two guests today. First of all, in the studio is Professor David MacDonald, a specialist on history of Russia, and Professor UW-Madison. David, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And joining us by phone is Konstantin von Eggert, straight from Moscow. Konstantin, you are there?
Yes, hello, Yuri. Hello, Professor MacDonald.
Hello.
It's wonderful. Konstantin, first, I'd like to, I guess, begin by congratulating you on a big award that you were presented with just very recently. If you could tell a little bit for the listeners, what is the nature of the prize? Because I saw a photograph, and there you are standing with Prime Minister Medvedev. what was the prize?
Yeah. Well, it's a prize that's awarded annually to Russian journalists for what is called an achievement, or rather, it's four achievements in the sphere of media. It is essentially the highest Russian prize in journalism, the awardees are selected by an independent committee of experts, including actually our colleagues and people from the media business, and it is presented on behalf of the Russian government whoever is the prime minister. So it is an independent selection which the government accepts as its own in a certain way. I think that was the reason why I thought that I could accept the prize, because, again, the selection was pretty independent, and it was a nice company of people with whom it was nice to receive a prize, because otherwise it really looked strange if the government was selecting journalists.
I suppose you always have to be careful who gives out the prize.
People who do complimentary coverage. So that was it. There was a nice ceremony and then a very nice cocktail reception, which we had a chance to speak to the Prime Minister. So, yeah, thank you very much for your congratulations, actually.
Absolutely. Well, let us get to the subject at hand, and that is we have Sochi 2014 Olympics coming up, and it seems more of the coverage these days is about the security of the event versus the athletic achievements that we're likely to witness. What is the perception that you're seeing, Konstantin, from Moscow of the upcoming Olympics? Are people excited?
I think that generally, of course, people are excited because, let's face it, it is an event that people, first and foremost of all, perceive as a sporting event. And I think that if you're talking about, if you wish, ordinary Russians, I don't know though, what are ordinary people, who are the ordinary Americans? I think they are different. Wisconsin and in Texas on the East Coast and in the Midwest. So the same goes for Russia, but I think generally you can say that people are looking forward to Olympic Games and to, you know, they hope to see their team winning. However, if you're talking about the intellectuals and journalists and NGO activists and just, I think, politically active people, then of course they see the event from a slightly different perspective, which is they see this event as something that's politically very important for President Putin. It's, if you wish, a prestige event that reflects on Russia's image in the world. And it also is an event which has shown quite a lot of negative stuff about Russia, including corruption, illegal migration and treatment of illegal migrants, securitization of the games, if you wish. You have to register to buy tickets, for example. And all these negative things definitely got their share of coverage, both inside and outside Russia. I think that the main thing to remember is that it is an extremely important event for President Putin, because it presents, if I may say so, is Russia to the world. And it would have been an important event because any head of state under whose watch the Olympics happen, feel a very special responsibility. Now, you have to remember that in 4 years' time, four and a half, something like that, Russia will host World Cup for football. And this is another event, which, by the way, may happen under President Putin's watch if he decides to go for re-election and wins the election. So it's, in a way, probably one of the two events in just 5 years that will focus attention on Russia.
Well, and that is rather interesting because, you know, being from Russia, to me, it seems that Olympics are almost a warm-up for the World Cup because that is the real event. You know, Olympics are nice and wonderful, and it's great to see your team do well, but soccer or football is the real deal, and the event itself is huge. So this is, you know, and Winter Olympics are always a little smaller anyway than Summer Olympics, so this does give them a kind of a test run.
If it was actually Sochi, is would have been much better for Summer Olympics because it's essentially sub-dropping. But I think that you're quite right. You have fewer athletes, fewer types of competitions, at the Winter Olympics rather than compared to the Summer Olympics. So, yes, it is right. I mean, the World Cup is bigger in many aspects.
All right.
Because the World Cup is watched and absorbed by people all over the globe, whether you have snow or not. So, yes, you're right in this respect.
All right.
And at the same time, I think in Russia, I forgot who said that. I think it was Harold Macmillan, the British Prime Minister, if I'm not mistaken. A week is a long time in politics. So in Russia, a year is a long time in politics, and a week is also a long time in politics. So you don't know what will happen in 1918, but the Winter Olympics are here and now, and it is very important for Putin to see these Olympics go smoothly.
Great. David, from a historical perspective, how do you see the importance of these games for Russia? Because these are the second Olympic Games in Russia, and the first ones were in 1980, and obviously there was a boycott of, American athletes did not come to the Olympics, and that really changed those games quite a bit. But how do you see these games being significant for Russia?
Well, I think Konstantin had it. I think internationally, it's a prestige on the international stage is almost like consumer behavior, that you want to have the prestige of hosting this big international event. I also agree that it's not as powerful and attractive as the World Cup in 4 years. Although I'll note parenthetically, as a Canadian, that I'm sure Russians and Canadians are very interested in the hockey tournament coming up. But I think the unspoken issue is the shadow of the boycott of the 80 games. And I think one of the things, it's sort of a delicate maneuver that Putin does as a politician, is he positions himself against the old regime. And this is one implicit way of doing it, to show that they can manage this international environment. I think they were sensitive about the possibility of a boycott over the LGBTQ legislation, the anti-gay propaganda law that came through last year. I think it gives him a chance politically to show his domestic audience that he is indeed a serious player internationally. He can handle relatively openly, compared with Leonid Ilyich, with Brezhnev, can handle these controversies. And I think it's supposed to display his competency. And I think the security issues...
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, Konstantin, you're there as well. And that really the two issues that I wanted to take a look at the Sochi Olympics. And part one is the security part of it. And part two is the certain thaw that we have witnessed, where we had several very significant political prisoners let out. And this is, I suppose, part of, and as David pointed out, contrasting the current regime with Brezhnev's regime in 1980, where people were just moved out of the area as much as possible to avoid contact with foreigners. So I guess if we're looking at this from the security point of view, there were 3 weeks ago, there were two explosions in a city of Volgograd that really kind of changed things so much that even President Putin had to re-record his New Year's address to the nation to include those events. And that really kind of changed the the outlook on the Olympics. What would make these Olympics a success, Konstantin, in your opinion, for Putin, for Russia?
I think if you're looking from the point of view of the Russian political regime, then of course it's first and foremost, well, I think here we can all say the same thing. It's letting them happen without any kind of terrorist atrocity.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very important task, I think, for Russian security services, is to, you know, make everything in their power to avoid anything along the lines of what happened in the city of Volgograd. That would have been a disaster. And remember that in 1972 in Munich,
mm-hmm.
the Summer Olympics were turned into, or they're memorable rather, for first and foremost of all, the kidnapping and then of the Israeli athletes by Palestinian terrorists and then their murder. So I think that this is the kind of publicity that, well, every government in the world would like to avoid. I suppose that the explosions that happened in Russia have shown that what we all know, but what we all in Russia do not really like to talk about, is that we have a low-intensity guerrilla war going on in the Russian North Caucasus and the immediate vicinity of Sochi. And this war could spill out over any time take the form of terrorist attacks against civilians. And this is something that the government would like to prevent. That is one political aspect of that. Another thing what the government would like to prevent is any kind of, major demonstrations by, supporters of LGBT or people demanding political freedom in Russia or demanding, say, the liberation of political prisoners here. That would be another sort of concern for government, because that is what it wants to avoid in front of, you know, global TV crews and global media assembled in Sochi. I think that these are the two tasks that are going to be very important for the government. And frankly speaking, as I think all of us, I do hope that in the first task they will not fail, because in Sochi, in the environment of the Olympic Games, any kind of terrorist attack may well be very deadly.
All right. My name is Yuri Rashkin, and my two guests are David McDonald, professor at UW-Madison, and a Russian journalist, Konstantin von Eggert. And this is the shining hour, potentially, for Russian security forces, which are usually so good at keeping people from expressing themselves and changing government. And more about, you know, protecting the government from the people. And here they have the opportunity to actually do what maybe they were designed for, and that is keeping people safe. And if they can't keep people safe, then it probably puts into question everything else. But the other part of the Sochi Olympics, and I'm just trying to kind of move through this a little quicker because Konstantin has limited time, and it is also your older daughter's birthday, so congratulations on that.
Thank you very much. Yeah, that's right, and I would like to finish some of the cake that we have. I hope that the good citizens of Madison will excuse me for trying to move out.
Absolutely.
The shadows.
Very much appreciate that you're here with us. But the certain thaw that we saw with Mikhail Khodorkovsky being released and members of Pussy Riot being released, what is the significance? What is the logic behind this, that Konstantin, that you see?
Well, I think with Pussy Riot it was pretty clear. Just like, by the way, with 30 Greenpeace activists that were detained by the Russian authorities a few months ago, and they were also released in the same by people that were released in December. Mr. Putin did not want the negative publicity that would have, by definition, been there because I think there would have been protests or demands for release of members of the Pussy Riot Pang Group, Pang Band. And also, I think the issue of Mr. Khodorkovsky was settled in a pretty, I would say, elegant way from the point of view of the government. Mr. Putin would have to set, would have had to set him free anyway in August, and he would have walked free, well, his own man in a way, now that he's been pardoned and claimed that it was his clemency. So he's trying to make at least something out of the situation which Mr. Khodorkovsky would have had to be set free in any case because he served his term. Now, Pussy Riot, a different story. I can imagine lots of people from the, you know, lots of megastars like, you know, other rock stars and pop stars demanding or heightening or focusing attention to Pussy Riot during the Olympics. And probably, well, you would have seen definitely demonstrations in their favor. And these demonstrations are usually very colorful. These are modern artists and activists. They do all sorts of inventive things that would have attracted the attention of the world media and had a negative image, negative publicity for Mr. Putin. So these two are, and Greenpeace activists, we know that Greenpeace is very well organized. No one wanted them, I don't know, to climb the main flagpole in Sochi and, you know, unfurl the Greenpeace flag or something like that. So Mr. Putin, I think, decided to, well, if he was clean the slate as much as he couldn't do anything about the LGBT law because it's federal law and he's not going to roll it back. Moreover, with the LGBT issue, he has, I mean, he has a different take on that because LGBT rights are not popular among 90% of the Russians. Any demonstrations in favor of LGBT rights, any demonstrations by gay activists actually play to the advantage of Mr. Putin domestically, and that's why, I mean, and anyway, he wouldn't have been able to resign a law that's been officially adopted by the Russian parliament, whether it's rubber stamp parliament or not, is besides the point, and he wouldn't roll it back. So he probably will have to, we'll probably witness demonstrations by, or some sort of performances or actions by gay activists during the Olympics. But again, as I said, Mr. Putin is not concerned about that. Professor McDonald mentioned the shadow of the boycott, and you mentioned, Yuri, that it's an attempt to look different from Mr. Brezhnev in 1980. I do remember the 1980 Olympics, and I think there was a, well, there is a big difference with Sochi for one simple reason. In 1980, President Carter, not only convinced the American, the U.S. Olympic Committee not to send an American team, which is one of the strongest teams in the world, to Moscow, but he also convinced a very strong team, for example, West Germany, not to send any athletes. And a lot of other countries boycotted the Olympics. So that was visible to the population. That was visible to regular Soviet citizens that you do not have Americans there. You do not have the Germans. They're very strong in especially for, you know, summer types of summer sports. Here today in Russia, we have, well, for example, the Chancellor of Germany or President of France, they declined to come to the ceremony. That is unpleasant for Mr. Putin, but it's something he can live with, let's face it. There is no Olympic boycott per se. All the countries that said that they will participate, and I think this is the only thing that really that he's really concerned about.
All right. Konstantin, in the few remaining minutes that we have with you, I'd like to touch on what is going on right now in Kyiv, Ukraine, well, in Ukraine in general, where new laws are being rushed through and have passed that basically make the protests illegal, and that really just infuriated the protesters even more. How do you see this playing out? What is the reaction in Moscow? What are you seeing about this?
Well, I think that in a certain way, Mr. Putin and the Kremlin, the Russian government, whatever you call them, are probably quite, well, I won't say satisfied, but they think that the situation is developing to their advantage for now. With the clashes between, violent clashes between the Ukrainian protesters and the police, this movement, this peaceful movement, has lost a bit of its luster because I think that the strength of such movements is nonviolence. And I think that now it would be easier for the Russian state propaganda to portray people in Ukraine as just, you know, rebel rousers and, you know, people who want to overthrow the government. Also, I suppose that in these circumstances, President Yanukovych has received a $15 billion credit from the Kremlin. Will feel more and more, if you wish, dependent on Moscow. And this is also what goes to the table, plays into the hands of President Putin. I think that developments in Ukraine are not over. They will continue because the civic society there is much more mature than it is in Russia. And it will give a lot of problems, both to the current Ukrainian government of President Yanukovych, who has to go for, he intends to go for re-election in early 2015. There are presidential elections there. And it will create a lot of problems for Moscow, because Moscow will have to support him. Moscow will have to pump more money into Ukraine to shore up the Yanukovych presidency. And it will still have to face people who are dissatisfied with this drift towards the Kremlin. And the civic society that is much more keen to defend its interests in the streets. So I think that we'll see continuing instability in Ukraine. The outcome, I will not be now willing to predict.
Yeah.
That Mr. Yanukovych has quite a bit of political, financial resources, financial resources at his disposal. But, you know, finance is important, money is important, but it's not the only thing that ensures political survival.
If I could jump in, added to what Konstantin was just saying, that it's not just the relative maturity of civil society in Ukraine, it's the deep divisions among regions, that whoever is going to be president and prime minister of that country has to figure out a way, and I don't know if it's possible, of reconciling the resource and heavy industry and largely Russian-speaking areas in the east with Galicia, people who came into the Soviet Union late, who are supported by a very strong and passionate diaspora, who provide them a lot of resources. And
there's the Poland is the counterweight there, isn't it?
Not really Poland, I think. It's just the fact that they're committed to an electoral solution to choosing governments that you saw it in the Yushchenko election, you saw it in the elections of Rada, and then you saw it in last presidential elections. There's extreme polarization between the two parts of the country, and you even see it reflected in the Maidan and in echo demonstrations throughout Ukraine.
So there are internal divisions as well.
Very deep.
I think I would like to add one thing to that. There are definitely divisions in Ukraine which are geographical, but my travels there recently have shown to me that because, as in Russia, we have got a new, completely post-Soviet generation of Ukrainians coming into adult life, I suppose that the issues of democracy, political orientation of the country, and stuff like that, also went increasingly, I think, not so much dependent on the regional difference, but also very much on differences in age, education, and occupation.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Kiev is not in Ukraine. Kiev is not in the west, in western Ukraine.
No,
isn't quite far from it. But President Yanukovych has lost Kiev because this is the city where you have a very large concentration of educated people, business people, students, and people like that. So, to some extent, it is regional, and that's true. But you saw pro-European, pro-democracy demonstrations in the eastern cities of Kharkiv and Donetsk, which usually were the bedrock of supports for Mr. Yanukovych, the current president. And I think that in these cities, you also see a younger generation of people who basically have different role models and different ideas about how to build Ukraine as a modern European state. So I suppose that the situation now became even more complex than, as you rightly said, in 2004 during the first sort of anti-government protests there, or the main, what they call the Orange Revolution, I think that now situation has become even more complicated. And this is very exciting, but of course it's also very difficult for the Ukrainian society to bridge all these differences. And here I would agree with Professor McDonald.
All right. Konstantin, thank you so much. If people, you know, so that we can get you a few more readers, not that you need, but because you're very popular already, but if people were going to read your writings, because you also write in English and in Russian, where can our listeners find and read more of Konstantin von Eggert?
Well, first of all, you can find me on Facebook. I'm Konstantin with a K, space V-O-N, space Eggert, E-G-G-E-R-T. So, I mean, you can follow me there. And also, I do write for the English website or English language section of the website of the Russian news agency RIA Novosti. At least I'm still writing for them. Please continue that. The address is em.ria.ru.
Thank you so much, Konstantin, for joining us, and please enjoy
the cake.
Thank you,
Yuri. Thank you, Professor McDonald. Have a great program.
You too. Thanks, Konstantin.
All right, David. Well, I guess we can reset the second half hour of the program. My name is Yuri Rashkin, and we are talking about Russia and Sochi Olympics. Joining me in the studio is UW-Madison Professor David McDonald. Professor, what are your thoughts on... I guess we kind of went through so fast for that first half hour. Is there something that you wanted to, mention first before we proceed?
Not really. Just on the last word on Ukraine, I think Konstantin was absolutely right to talk about the generational split. But even there, the one thing I would have added to what he said was that 2004 forms an interesting backdrop again to the current events, especially since the goal, what they're trying to achieve, is much less apparent or some sort of point of consensus. That you see it with the REC fracture between who was it, Vitaly Klitschko, the leader of
the boxer,
who's the political leader, and a guy Batsenyuk, who's another leader. That you're getting people who are trying to contain the violence to show that they can be responsible statespersons, and they're being defied by a lot of the people on the square, and that plays into Yanukovych's hands, I'm afraid.
Well, and dare I say, that's what makes politics so fun.
Yes, is that,
you know, because you have divisions within the country, you have divisions within the generations, within the education levels, within the international borders, and all of that is you see with people out on the street and trying to demand, you know, demanding change, but they're not in this case, unlike 2004, where they're demanding a certain person out of power and a certain person in power. Here they're actually going for more of an international agreement. I don't know how often you see the protests for international agreements.
Well, that and also internal compromise. The compromise has been something that's been totally off the table since 2004. There was a solution forced on a powerful minority as a result of the Orange Revolution. Either depending on how it works out, I was interested to see, and I'm not by any means an apologist for the Yanukovych government, but there's noises coming out of Kiev that they are trying to initiate negotiations with representatives of civil society, and that something like that could be an important step forward. But I don't see a quick or easy resolution to that society anytime soon.
Well, I would imagine anytime you have a fairly weakened dictator in the corner, things get unpredictable.
Yes, ask Bashar al-Assad.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And you never know how painful the transition or how long it's going to take. One of the things that Konstantin mentioned that I thought was so interesting is in explaining the reasons for the thaw, for the amnesty, for release of some of these prisoners, and I know we didn't cover, outside of Pussy Riot, which I think has a great name to begin with, but many people, I think, either heard their music or understand that there's a punk band. But Khodorkovsky I don't know if he's a millionaire now, he was a billionaire before, and he tried to mount opposition, politically speaking, to Putin, and he spent 10 years in prison. And even though he had 8 months left until his term was over, I am not sure that this was his first term that he was serving. I think it was extended.
Yeah.
And with Putin in power, you can presume that there was a good chance that it would have been extended again. So being out is good no matter how you slice it, even though he got out, got on a plane, and went to Germany right away. for those that are not following this exciting saga. But what caught my attention with Constantine is that in his explanation of Putin's logic, there was nothing outside of this. This is just politics. I think everyone accepts it as such, that there is nothing like, we're going to do things different, you know.
No. He was actually underscoring. I think the thing Constantine brought out that I would emphasize and actually make more of is he was exercising clemency, like milis, as they used to say in the imperial era.
Charity almost.
Mercy. Yeah. And he was showing himself simultaneously to be a statesman, magnanimous soul who could rise above these petty, seemingly personal feuds. B, he was making an important statement to the remaining holders of a great deal of capital or assets that lesson learned, boys. I went after Khodorkovsky because he was organizing my enemies, and that's the price he paid. And I'm trusting you've learned the lesson. Just look at Misha Prokhorov over there. He's learning the same thing. I just saw that his party was denied registration status by the Electoral Commission in Russia. And Prokhorov is sort of a domesticated version. He's the guy that owns the Brooklyn Nets, for those of you that follow American sports. He is sort of a domesticated version of Khodorkovsky, but well within the bounds that Putin would understand as legitimate. And finally, to Khodorkovsky, he's saying, this is a power play. I didn't have to do this. The hell with you. Go see what you can do now without a domestic base and without your resources. And see you later.
Right. And this does seem to be a model that's been adopted by strongmen all over now, where you have a free, so to say, market where people are allowed to make money but do not get involved in politics.
Oh, that's the one running argument I've had with a lot of friends who over the last 15, 20 years specialize either in Russia or in general questions of historical change. There's been this, we inherited a myth broadly thought, not it's a lie, just we tended to, we being from the English-speaking world or Northwest Europe, going back to the 18th century in the Scottish Enlightenment, we tended to think that our path of development, a market economy, brought rule of law, human rights, blah, 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 that this was a pattern, this was a normal pattern, quote unquote, that once it was replicated elsewhere in the world would bring similar consequences. Mm-hmm. And wherever we look around the world, we can look at Singapore, look at the Philippines, look at South Korea until about 15 years ago, maybe, but certainly post-Mao China and post-communist Russia, okay, there's nothing that indicates that this is an ironclad law of history.
Although it does, I suppose, following that argument, eventually creates aristocracy, which eventually could challenge the power structure, eventually, if it's not beheaded first.
Oh, yeah, no, we've got Renaissance Italy, we've got the 1920s Chicago. There's all sorts of models. Being a big fan of The Godfather, that's the one that always comes to my mind. But
all right. So a little bit more, I guess, to step back to the Olympics. You know, my connection between Moscow Olympics and Sochi Olympics is that I was in Moscow and I was 5 years old, and everyone was encouraged to leave Moscow because foreigners were coming. And my parents took me to visit my family in Crimea, and that was actually the first and last time I've been in Sochi. So there's my connection. But then I also lived in Salt Lake City during the 2002 Winter Olympics, which saw an amazing coming together of white people from all over the world.
Well, that's the Winter Olympics.
Right. And the security there was right after 9/11. Yep. And it felt probably something to what we experience in airports now, mm-hmm, where you go through a metal detector and you go in. But the interesting thing there, and this is a historical pattern, America offers Russia assistance in security or in whatever sphere, and Russia, you know, politely or not, declines. Yeah. What is the logic there?
Oh, you're just in the United States, the same thing. I think it's part of the psychology of being a certain type of state that your sovereignty is exclusively yours to protect. and that if you're allowing other people on, it's less the access to secrets or your procedures or modus operandi. It's more giving the appearance. And again, it's this whole world of appearances as part of prestige. You are somehow implicitly admitting that you're not up to the task. And so it's a blot on your scutcheon. It's a loss of face. And so I think that's more it, especially when you're making claims about the prestige and authority of state power to your population. It doesn't look good.
Well, and I suppose on this note, it's fitting to mention that today is actually 90th anniversary since passing of Vladimir Lenin, who started this whole thing. Well, he didn't start it, but he started the Soviet Union. And now that's been gone for 25 years almost?
22 years on Christmas Day, yeah.
Does it feel like much has changed?
Yes. And I think that's something we often lose sight of. On the one hand, I can see continuities, but this strong centralized state, this idea that the state is supposed to be a mobilizer and coordinator of resources in the population, the idea that the state is responsible for representing various constituencies that are seen as somehow essentialized, whether it's by class, whether ethnic belonging, regional background or that. So in many ways, the language of state resonates, well, obviously with Soviet language, but even with imperial language, the language of the state
very much
during
so,
the 19th
yes.
and 18th and 19th century. But underneath that, and I think my friends in Russia often lose sight of it. My baseline is always being in what was then called Leningrad, well, at least officially. My friends there all called it Petersburg, during the 1970s. Material life has changed enormously, even if that's been accompanied by a more visible maldistribution of wealth. The visibility, I think, isn't a bad thing, and it gives people, especially people interested in mobilizing, a clear idea of what is what. It's a good and interesting test of the norms of society. You'll probably remember the whole the cult of the new Russians in the mid-90s and late 90s,
right.
And sort of the parvenu who were conspicuous consumers. But more importantly, you can get stuff that you used to have to go to the black market for or wait in line for forever.
So if freedom means supermarket,
Then we're there, almost. Yeah, they've almost realized the
at
real
least the
socialism.
Doors are open, yeah, but yeah. If you don't have money to buy, then that's a different story.
True. Although even my less well off friends certainly don't live in the same type of penury that they did in the 1970s. Even I'd say the realm of expression. I think it's ironic, but I hear stuff on the streets or in bars in Russia now that you would not have heard beyond two sets of closed doors. And there was
right.
always a very lively civil culture, but it was an archipelago of a million islands of little groups of friends, kruzhki circles, who were gathered za stolom at the table with vodka.
In the kitchen,
yeah,
right.
Of kuchnia, and vodka, the sardines, sala.
So you can share your trouble, then you can bury them.
That's right. And once you go out in the street, it's always the same deadpan expression, right? Whereas now you're seeing more expression, still not the formation of a civil society, but I can hear things on the street. I can see things at newsstands that would have gotten people put away in the big house in Petersburg
right.
forever. I can go on the internet and read ranges of opinion from hair-raising far right to
hair-raising far left.
To unreconstructed true old believers. But what's interesting, and Konstantin referred to intellectuals, I think that this government has taken a version of the strategy that the Thatcher government, and I argue the Reagan administration, took in the 1980s. They let people like us chatter away, mm-hmm. and what they did was say, well, we're never going to convert them anyway. And in funny ways, it's like Romney talking about the
47%. Right.
And so they don't even waste time with us. They talk to their base. They cultivate their base. Let the people in the talking shops talk what they want. They're just a bunch of elite snobs anyway.
You know, I will say that for leadership, it develops, it requires a certain level of maturity
yes.
to ignore criticism.
Yeah.
We have a couple of phone calls, so caller, welcome to the program. Please state your name and the reason for your phone call.
Good afternoon. I never visited the Soviet Union, but I did visit Hungary, which was nominally
yep.
a socialist country still. in 1989, and I was met by Hungarian folks at the train station. They brought me to someone's apartment that had been vacated for the weekend, and I paid all of like $5 or $10
yep.
to stay there for the whole weekend. My question is, now that Moscow is one of the most expensive cities in the world, how is this free market, laissez-faire, ruthless capitalism treating Russian citizens who are out in the street, and how many of them are out in the street now?
The people who are suffering most, I would say, are pensioners. And it's something we often lose sight of with the end of the Soviet Union, was that, and it's actually an important background to explaining Putin and how he maintains just unreal popularity numbers. His popularity is down. I was just looking at polls from December. He's down into approval ratings of 65 or that. That's something that a sitting American president would murder for. But what we often forget is, even under Soviet socialism, people saved. They depended on the state to provide them benefits, housing, health care, and the rest of it. And that infrastructure dissipated in a matter of three or four years. Savings, inflation devoured savings, pension benefits totally declined, and you had probably two generations who had no means with which to adapt to the new world. And there's no question that they're taking a hammering, and they're very hurting. The uneducated people in Moscow who have not been able to adapt, and there are good reasons, all sorts of good reasons that they haven't. The same in Petersburg. They are the real victims. Also, localities that were built as Soviet versions of company towns. If you go up in the north in places like Magadan and Norilsk, or the agricultural sector, they have also really hurt as well, because that the new free market capitalism that's supposed to save everybody, these guys took very self-serving decisions for reasons that we'd hear explained elsewhere in this country, that it just didn't make money to keep running nickel mines up there or the rest of it. And so if you're living in the wrong type of regional center, you've also taken a huge hit, because there's nowhere you can go. Moscow doesn't have most cities, their infrastructures are taking in new populations, are already strained to breaking. And that's also agriculture, as it becomes more quote-unquote efficient, you're getting a surplus population coming off the land there and nowhere for them to go. No, so there's a lot of the disowned, but Putin appeals to them very well by saying, it's not us, we're working to correct it, it's all these, and then name your unpopular minority, and he'll blame it on them.
That is always the case in Russia. We have another phone call, but first I wanted to mention that, as far as, I guess, in defense of free markets, I had relatives of mine that came over to visit, and while they live in Moscow, and they're doing okay, they're coming to United States. Before, they used to come for the selection. Now they come for the price.
Because we're
actually less expensive
very
than
much
Moscow.
More so. Yeah, yeah.
All right, caller, welcome to the program. If you would please state your name and the reason for your phone call.
Hi. Can you explain the connections between the Eurocentric protest and extreme right-wing anti-Semitic forces?
In Ukraine?
Yes, please.
I haven't read a lot about it, but it wouldn't surprise me that anybody that there's in Ukraine... I don't think it's news to say that there's been a well-established streak of anti-Semitism. It varies in how deeply or widely it expresses itself. And any chance that that constituency gets from introduction to disorder, they're going to do what they can. But I don't think they're operating in tandem with the main part of the group demonstrating in Yevromaidan.
David, we have a couple of phone calls, but I guess I have a quick question for you as well. As a Jewish person myself, of Jewish ethnicity, I am thrilled that they're currently not beating Jews in Russia, but instead they decided to center on gays.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, this is a long conversation of many, many things that are wrong with this, but I'm also not seeing that dynamic, unless you do, pop up in the Maidan and the Kyiv protests, which is once again tells me that this is government pushing things down on people in Russia and, feeding the flames of this particular hatred, which doesn't really exist even in Ukraine next door so much, although the historical, history of anti-Semitism in Ukraine is well documented.
Yeah. No, I think, the anti-gay legislation, there are two things going on. One is again, to go back to what I was saying earlier, and using an American expression, he's playing to his base.
Right.
That I would suspect, no matter what the polls say, he's lost Moscow, he's lost Petersburg, he's probably lost Nizhny Novgorod. That sort of the more prosperous bet, but Novosibirsk probably never had, and Irkutsk, who knows. But there's a lot of regions in Russia where he's still very strong, and which...
Well, there's a certain, actually, very similar dynamic between Republicans and Democrats and Putin and whoever the opposition is, where the big cities may lean Democratic or against Putin.
So.
Just the dynamics are the same.
Very much so.
Rural areas being for Putin.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. So he's playing to the base, but the other element that nobody wants to talk about is a test to the rising influence of the Orthodox Church.
Mm-hmm.
And the great winner in Russia since 1991, it hasn't been the oligarchs, it hasn't been Putin, it's been the Orthodox Church. They had all their property restored to them. You haven't been there, but if you go to Red Square or go to or the new Christ the Savior that was rebuilt on the street, site of the Gorky Street Baths,
it is truly amazing, because when I left, the country was atheistic. There was no God.
Yeah.
But now there was a controversy when the Olympic team or sports team, whatever, left for a sporting event without a group prayer first.
Yeah.
So things change. Oh, right. A couple of phone calls. All right. So, caller, welcome to the program. Please state your name and the reason for your phone call.
Yeah, hi. My name is Methuselah, and I've got two questions for you. The first one, I don't know if you've discussed this before, but I had a question about Edward Snowden. Do you think he will continue to stay in Russia? It would seem to me that right now that would be one of the safest countries for him to remain in, where he would be least subject to harassment by the U.S. security services. And also, many accounts one reads about Edward Snowden, they compare him to the defectors that went to the Soviet Union during communist times and the difficulties that those defectors have. But, I mean, I don't think that's necessarily the case anymore with life in the Soviet Union, at least not if you have financial support. I mean, I think life now would be a little different than life in the West. My second question, could you say something about the Chukotsky National Okrug, the part of Russia that's closest to Alaska? Is that still governed by a wealthy gentleman who lives in London? And do you think that any of the hype about developing that area or expanding links with Alaska are realistic, or are they a lot of hype? Because as I understand it, that part of Russia has no surface transportation connections with the rest of the country. And I can just take my answers off the air. And thanks for an interesting program.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for your phone call, Methuselah. David, I guess I just remember when Abramovich, who was the governor owner of Chelsea, that won numerous championships since he purchased them. I remember reading that people of Chukotka were very interested in having him reelected because he was actually spending his own money.
to
improve the district. So, if you wanted to say a couple of things about that, and as far as Edward Snowden, you've been to Russia recently. If you were in his shoes, is that the place that you want to be?
I know that Glenn Greenwald is trying to talk with Dilma Rousseff and the Brazilian government about finding ways to get him over there, too. And I think Snowden's a useful asset for the Russian government. Whatever, and I won't get into discussion about what he did or whether it's merits or whatever, but I have no question that American government would have done exactly the same thing had a Russian popped onto their doorstep with similar materials. But I think Snowden will stay there for as long as it takes to get to Brazil. On Chukotka, all I could say
and,
is...
And we're talking very far, this is practically Alaska.
Yeah, yeah, and it's mainly populated by First Nations, and there might be reserves up there. In terms of relations with Alaska, I think there are already several links from, Petropavlovsk and Vladivostok, which is really the maritime district to the south, but... I don't see a lot happening there, especially if Abramovich doesn't continue spending his own money. The one thing you don't want to be in Russia is far away from Moscow or far away from resources, and Chukotka is both.
All right. Public Affairs Hour. My name is Yuri Rashkin, and my guest is UW-Madison professor David MacDonald. David, in a few remaining minutes, what are the things that people should pay attention to these days about Russia, if they're curious in that part of the world, because it still occupies 12
time zones.
12 time zones.
Yeah, we're always reminded of that.
Right, even though the population keeps shrinking,
yeah,
it still is important.
I think there's plenty to pay attention to, depending on what you're interested in. I think Ukraine bears further watching. It's again, to go back to what Konstantin said, one thing that Yanukovych has to do, and what he's trying to do, interestingly, is he can't get too close to Russia or he loses too much domestic support. And so he's already made noises that he's reopening negotiations with the European Union, and he's trying to find some way to balance between them, having pocketed this $15 billion from the Russian Federation.
This is part of the corrupted problem that people are so upset about.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Putin wants his money back.
Yeah. Well, Putin being a strict defender of standards and probity, yeah. But I think what you want to watch with Russia is international involvement right now. And here is a country that had a recession worse than ours in 1997. It's come through the recession that we've just come through with the head cold, not with the pneumonia that we had. And what he's been doing since he came to power in late 99 is trying to reestablish Russia as close as possible to the status it enjoyed during the Cold War, of one of the duumvirate in the world. Now, he's right. Realistic enough to know that it ain't like that anymore. But the United States, it can't be a unilateral hegemon anymore either. And so what you watch is Putin's relations with China, to whom he paid glowing court in a press conference last week that some American viewers might have seen parts of on George Stephanopoulos. He's also claimed a role at the table very productively for Russian interests in resolving the Iran nuclear development issue and in the current multilateral talks on Syria. So there, watch how he's brokering himself back into a position of parity, rough parity, with the United States. And that plays beautifully to his audience. The one thing that they all like to see is Russia being taken seriously.
Right, and that is true, because that is what every Russian, theoretically, there is that very strong national pride,
yeah,
which has been there through the times of, I'm sure, empire and Soviet Union for
yes,
sure,
yeah.
And they're trying to reestablish it now without the communist ideology, maybe substituting that with Russian Orthodox Church, as you said, which is a very, very big issue. And of course, going through the recession that, like you said, they got out with the cold, we got out with pneumonia. In part, it is because they gave away and they're historically dependent on natural resources.
Absolutely, and they've not found a way out of that.
Right, because we're trying to preserve ours. They're saying, hey, this is money.
Yeah.
So it's a short term gain, long term loss, and now they're trying to make it work on a political level, which is probably less damaging to the environment.
Yeah.
David, what an awesome conversation. Thank you so much
for
being on the
it.
Program. We have just a few seconds left, so I will say that, what should I say? I should say that Sochi Olympics are going to be fun to watch, but there's going to be a lot more there than meets the eye. And you know that Russian government is going to do everything they can to put together a pretty picture, as any network responsible is going to do the same. And hopefully everyone will be safe.